Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future. Brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. I'm your host, Bob Bixby. Each week, we take a nonpartisan dive into topics related to the federal budget, the economy, and how they affect our nation's future. We'll bring you the facts and some timely commentary from policymakers, experts, and grassroots leaders from across the country. This week, we'll take a look at the surprising and disappointing April jobs report with economist Diane Lim. She's the author of the economistmom.com blog. We'll also get Diane's take on President Biden's policy agenda and how it's paid for. Before we get to the interview, here's some background information. Last week, the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics released its employment situation summary for April 2021. Otherwise known as the jobs report. It landed with a thud because the estimated jobs gained in April, 226,000, was far below expectations of 1 million or so jobs gained. Now, normally 266,000 jobs would have been a great number, but these aren't normal times. In March, for example, 770,000 jobs were added, and more were expected in April because it appeared that the economy was coming back to life. There was some good news in the report in that the biggest gain came in the leisure and hospitality sector, which added 331,000 jobs. In other words, more than the total. They did more than their fair share of job growth. So that sector has been particularly hard hit. But it's still down almost 3 million jobs, or about 17%, since February of 2020. Other industries did not fare as well, with manufacturing, retail, and healthcare all down slightly, and construction remaining about the same. So, whenever a disappointing number comes out, Washington goes into a frenzy of finger pointing, and this was no exception. Republicans blamed the weekly $300 unemployment compensation bonus payments extended by the president, by the Biden administration and Congress in March. By some estimates, about half of the unemployed can get a higher income with these bonus payments than if they went back to work. Those payments are scheduled to expire in September. Democrats said the problem is lack of adequate and affordable child care, keeping many workers, especially women, from being able to re-enter the workforce. Of course, it could be that many people are simply still cautious about going back to work because of safety concerns, or it could be that the whole thing is sort of a statistical blip, and things will look a little bit more as expected next month. We'll see. We'll look at all of this and what it means for the future with my guest, economist Diane Lim, right after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Bob Bixby, and my guest this week is Diane Lim. Diane is a familiar guest on this program. She spent her 30-plus year career in a variety of prominent roles in the federal government and the nonprofit sector and academic sectors. She began her career as an assistant professor at Penn State University, worked at the Congressional Budget Office in the early 1990s, and served as chief economist for the House Ways and Means Committee, House Budget Committee, the Pew Charitable Trust, and an organization called the Concord Coalition. She was a senior economist on the staff of the President's Council of Economic Advisers during the final year of the Clinton administration and stayed for the first 100 days of the George W. Bush administration. And she's worked for the Conference Board, the Brookings Institution, the Urban Institute and Penn Wharton budget model. She's a past president of the National Tax Association, received her doctoral degree in economics from the University of Virginia in 1991, but we know her best as the author of the EconomistMom.com blog, which she started when she was with the Concord Coalition, dropped it for a little while, and has picked it up recently. So, Diane, we're going to be talking to you today as the Economist Mom and getting all sorts of good advice about the jobs report and the Biden agenda. So,
yep. Nice.
Welcome
to be
back
here,
to Facing the Future.
Thank you, Bob. It's good to be here with you.
Okay. Let's start with the jobs report. As I was saying earlier, it certainly hit with a thud, a little bit of a disappointment. What a lot of reasons have been postulated for why it happened. What's your take?
Well, you know, the expectation was kind of, I feel like it was overhyped. I guess the consensus expectation was that over a million or around a million jobs would be added on the establishment side of the survey, which is the business side of the survey. And we only got a quarter of that. So 200 some thousand jobs. And I believe the previous month was also revised downward a bit in terms of the jobs added. I frankly was not surprised. Like when I actually first heard the number and I hadn't been keeping up with that, what the expectation was, I thought, oh, that's pretty good. I mean, so it was kind of a shock to me when some reporters started calling me and said, why is it so low? And because I just hadn't been keeping up with the expectation. You know, let's face it, this has been an unprecedented stoppage of the economy due to a public health pandemic. While, you know, early in the pandemic last spring, we had expectations of a V-shaped recovery because we thought, you know, why did we have the expectation of such a dramatically quick recovery? Because we thought the pandemic crisis, the public health part of the crisis, was only going to last a couple months. You know, I remember everyone was, first it was like, maybe it'll be a couple weeks that we have to stay at home. And then it was, well, maybe just a couple months that we have to stay at home. And then suddenly we were in the middle of the summer and we were starting to talk about whether the kids could go back to school in the fall. This was all like, the news just kept getting worse and worse. It's like, wait a minute, I thought this was just a temporary thing. So the longer, and if you think about the way, what precipitated the economic part of the pandemic, the economic shutdown, virtual shutdown, was from some systemic economic weakness or vulnerability that reared its ugly head, but from something that didn't have anything to do with the economy, right? And so the way that it shut down the economy didn't really have any economic rhyme or reason. You know, it shut down the parts of the economy that were the most people intensive parts of the economy. And those were, before the pandemic, actually the strongest growing sectors of the economy. So it kind of flipped the economy upside down in terms of which sectors of the economy and what jobs were the most vibrant and the most stable and the most growing in terms of demand for its labor. And because that is sort of random from an economic standpoint, and then it lasted, the fact that those jobs were primarily held in, you know, leisure, hospitality, human service industries. If you think about leisure, hospitality, education, you know, discretionary health services other than emergency, right? So like routine doctor's appointments, personal care, you know, clubs, health clubs, gyms.
Everybody got fat and let their hair grow out.
So all of that, you know, if you think about who works in those industries that sort of take care of us and feed us and keep us, you know, moving around in our economies and society, those jobs interacting with people are disproportionately held by women. they're also disproportionately held by younger people, right? And people of color, it turns out. A lot of the leisure hospitality workers are immigrant workers. Those were also the people in the economy that ended up, as the pandemic wore on into the fall and the kids were not going back to school, then suddenly there was yet another reason why it wasn't going to be easy to get back up to pre-pandemic speed. Even after people were starting to get rehired, businesses were starting to open up, suddenly it had lasted long enough and the constraints on the supply of labor had gotten tight enough and actually more burdensome that we were seeing difficulty getting the supply side of the labor market back in action.
Yeah, that's what seems so demand. So interesting. Maybe interesting isn't the right word, but I mean, it's the phenomenon seems to be the demand is coming back faster than labor supply, yes. Which isn't typical of a recession. So it's the, what was interesting, one of the things that was interesting and encouraging about this report was that the leisure and hospitality sector led the way. I mean, there were over 330,000 jobs, more than, you know, so the other sectors, construction, there wasn't so much construction, but manufacturing, retail, nobody really took a big hit, but a lot of other sectors were down enough to keep the total from being more buoyant than you were thinking. But it did look like, you know, wages were up and hiring in the leisure and hospitality sector was up. So there's a lot of noise in this report that's hard to interpret. Two of the things that were, you know, getting debated in Washington as people engage in the blame game. And it is quite interesting that you mention, if you hadn't been paying attention to the expectations, you'd say, that was a great jobs report. Any other week, you'd look at 266,000 jobs created and you say, wow, that's great. Right? The economy is doing really well. Expectations have a lot, but so everything has to have a political game, blame game in Washington. So the Republicans say, well, it's those unemployment payments, the bonus $300 payments that were enacted in March, an extension of an earlier bonus. And the Democrats say, no, it's lack of adequate childcare because people can't go back to work. Parents can't go back to work, particularly women, as you mentioned, or people might just still be reluctant to go back because of safety concerns. I'm not sure that, or maybe it's just a statistical aberration, but I mean, do you have any feeling about what contributed more to this, or is it just
Yeah, I think that if you look at the, you know, as you said, the only sector that seemed to show a pretty strong gain in jobs on the establishment side is leisure hospitality, which to me isn't surprising given that obviously the leisure hospitality took the biggest hit the entire pandemic. So they are starting coming up from a low number. They were basically virtually shut down.
And I should point out that they're still down, way down.
They're still way down. But I mean, you know, it shouldn't be that surprising that a 1 month increase is pretty big in leisure hospitality, given the starting point, right, the month before. So the other thing to keep in mind is leisure hospitality jobs, they're not great jobs, but they are agile jobs. That is a very agile part of the labor market because they're part-time hourly wage jobs for the most part, right? They're not full-time permanent jobs. You know, they're usually temporary jobs that a lot of young people take for the summer or on a part-time basis to, you know, do while they're going through school. We shouldn't be surprised that it's fairly easy for an employer in the leisure hospitality sector to hire workers as long as they're offering high enough wages, right? Like the solution is just, you know, if they're having trouble recruiting people at the fast food shop, you know, then maybe they just need to offer a higher hourly wage. Or some fast food places have been offering like signing bonuses to accept a part-time job. You know, we'll give you $200, you know, or an Amazon gift card or something if you take a job with us. And you don't even have to return it until you, you know, if you leave after a month, you know. So I think that obviously young workers are working hourly wage jobs are the easiest to implement traditional economic market strategies on, you know, which tells economic theory says, if you have a shortage of workers, it means you're not paying high enough wages. So just pay them higher wages. And that works. That solves the problem. You know, maybe they're not yet high enough, but also even in leisure hospitality, I have to say, those young people who take those jobs, you know, some of them are still finishing their semesters in college. So I just want to, it's a very seasonal pool of workers. And
yeah, it does seem like this is a transitional report, or probably not a report you can make a lot of projections based right. on. It just seems like there's a lot of, we got to wait another couple of months to see how it sort of plays out in the broader economy. Yeah. When you were here on the show last time, and I know you've talked about this a lot, you know, you were mentioning that this is referred to sometimes as not just a recession, but a she-cession, because yeah. it's had more of an impact on women. Is that still the case? And is the data still showing that?
It depends how you measure it. If you look at overall unemployment, the unemployment rate among men versus women, you know, what made it the she-cession in the spring of last year was that women went from having a significantly lower overall unemployment rate from men to having a dramatically higher unemployment rate from men just in, you know, April and May, just going from February, March, April, May, that huge trajectory of, you know, just this unbelievable double-digit increase in unemployment rate for women overall. So it was called the she-cession because of that. That was the effect of mostly the sectors of the economy, the occupations that women held disproportionately in the leisure hospitality sector and in other kind of personal care industries, human intensive jobs. And then it started to recover slowly over the course of the year as overall unemployment rate came down. And by late last year, early this year, we started to see the female unemployment rate overall dip below the male unemployment rate. So if you define it just by whose unemployment rate is higher, you would say, oh, it's not a she-cession anymore because the overall male unemployment rate is now higher, like it used to be before the pandemic. But if you look at what's going on, like if you try to disaggregate the data a little bit more, you see that all women are not created equal. All men are not created equal in the job market. And once you divide up men and women by race, you see these patterns that make it clear that for a lot of women, particularly women of color, particularly Asian and Hispanic women, but also white women to some extent, their employment to population ratio has stayed at a depressed level compared to what's going on with the men in the same race categories. So there seems to be some division of labor at home that is operating as a constraint on the division of labor between a husband and a wife in the labor market, at least. And a lot of the women who have not come back, who have not recovered from the first part of the pandemic, in terms of labor force participation, are women that tend to be married to men who are secondary earners, not primary earners in their household. And therefore, they make the most sense to stay at home with the kids or elderly parents if someone needs to stay at home with them. So that supply side constraint is still obviously very binding for a lot of previously working women. And I think that this is the hardest part of the labor market to get back to pre-pandemic status right now.
This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Bob Bixby, and I've been discussing the April jobs report with Diane Lim, author of the EconomistMom.com blog. Diane and I will be right back after these short messages to talk about President Biden's Go Big policy agenda. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Bob Bixby, and I'm talking to TheEconomistMom.com, Diane Lim, former chief economist for the Concord Coalition. And Diane has held a number of positions throughout government in both the executive and congressional branches. Diane, in this segment, I want to pick up. We were talking about the jobs report in the last segment, and it kind of segues into President Biden's ambitious policy agenda. He's basically put out two big plans since the COVID relief plan. One is the American Jobs Plan, which is geared at infrastructure and a broader definition of infrastructure to include some human infrastructure. And then there's the American Families Plan, which goes more explicitly towards the care economy, people, you know, child care, dependent care, things that are intended to help families participate in the workforce. So it's all very very ambitious. And I wanted to get your overall take on just the policy proposals first before we get into some of the other aspects of how you would pay for it or, you know, the timing of things. Just overall, what's your take on these two policy proposals?
I think they're very ambitious, and I also think they're pretty smart. I'm viewing this from a longer-term recovery perspective. Like, if your goal with your economic policy is not simply to get us back to where we were pre-pandemic, but get us onto a more sustainably growing path for the economy, then you see that the fundamental elements of these latest installments of the Build Back Better agenda, which are the American Jobs Plan and the American Families Plan, they're really about making some investments in the supply side of our economy, like trying to grow the productive capacity, trying to literally expand our notion of potential GDP, right? And rather than trying to stimulate the demand side of the economy to get us to our previous potential GDP, it's like, gee, can we expand our potential, not just our actual, right?
And we need that. I mean, the projections going forward with the population, the workforce growth projections slowing.
Yes.
Either you got to bring more people into the workforce or bring more people into the country through immigration.
That's right. And we're not doing very well with the bring more people into the country with immigration policy pretty much stalled for a long time. So the question becomes, how can we work on expanding the productive capacity of our economy, given our existing human base, you know, productive base? This is something economists don't know a lot about, because we're talking about bringing people into the economy that maybe we've never seen before in the economy, or maybe they've been participating to a very limited extent because they're women and minorities and, you know, people yet to be born, or people yet to become full-fledged working productive adults, right? So it's something that I think is a fundamentally new strategy for this country, is to pursue economic policy that works on the human side of the supply side. I would say that, you know, the first package called the American Jobs Plan, it has been thought of as the infrastructure bill, but it actually doesn't have a lot about human infrastructure. It says, it kind of made it sound like it had a lot, but if you look closely at the specific proposals within the American Jobs Plan, it's more about physical infrastructure. It's like the traditional notion of infrastructure that economists and policymakers think of, which is building things, Right, building things. And so even the elements of the American Jobs Plan that touch upon the caregiving economy, it's really by building better daycare centers, building, you know, better technology within assisted living facilities. It's, you know, like improving the physical infrastructure, the physical capacity of the caregiving sector. It's not until you get to the American Families Plan that where I think that's the real meat of the real, you know, human side of the human infrastructure idea and the support of the caregiving economy. So if you look at the American Families Plan, what strikes me as being most exciting in terms of the potential it could bring to the economy is that it's essentially subsidizing families, subsidizing not just families, I mean, subsidizing having kids by making it more affordable to have kids because of two big things it does. It proposes universal preschool. So that's like free childcare for preschool age kids, right? And it proposes subsidized childcare costs for any kids that need childcare. You know, that would be based on one's income. So if you're a low income household, you wouldn't have to pay more than, you know, a certain fraction of your income in childcare costs. And then on the opposite end of the childhood spectrum, it's offering free community college, right? So if you think about the major costs of having children in the United States, because our government doesn't really help us very much, you help out with the cost of raising a kid very much, unlike a lot of European countries. In the US, the big costs are childcare when they're young and college when they're out of the house, when they leave high school. And by if the government's really gonna pay for that, that is a big subsidy to the cost of having children. It will improve the affordability of having a kid. And while I've never thought that, you know, if the government expands the child care tax credit or the child tax credit a little bit, that will cause people, that will incentivize people to have more kids. Or if the EITC is a function of how many kids you have, you know, that it'll give people the incentive to have an extra kid at the margin. I've always scoffed at those notions that the decision to have kids is the same kind of decision as the decision to buy an extra jar of pickles or something at the grocery store. You know, it's not the same kind of decision. It's not continuous like that. It's very lumpy. It's very big. And there are a lot of factors way more important than prices that determine whether people have children. So, but this is different because the way people decide to have kids is because they want to for much bigger reasons other than economic. And then they ask the question, but can I afford to have children? And that has been the number one thing that has stopped, you know, people my kids' age in their 20s from having children, even though they're already working adults with pretty good high paying jobs.
This really does seem like a fundamental shift in society that we're trying to address here. And you know what it seems like to me, because agreeing with all of what you said there, then the question comes up is, you know, how do you pay for it? Because if the government is paying for it, obviously it's either going to be doing it through taxation, and if it's doing something new, that means a new source of taxation or higher from the same sources, or borrowing the money. I mean, one way or the other. And before we get into that, it does just strike me as kind of like a new set of entitlements almost. I mean, what you just described is like, we've got the great society for the elderly and this is the great society for the young. So then the question is, you know, with Social Security and Medicare, you had payroll taxes, premiums somehow. This one has President Biden isn't proposing just dedicated revenues, but just higher general revenues from corporations and higher income individuals. So, A, your take on the need to pay for stuff be the your take on the methods that President Biden has proposed?
I do think that we need to pay for things as long as, you know, I think it's a comparison of here's where marginal does matter, marginal cost versus marginal benefit of the policy, right? In terms of the overall federal budget and the US economy. And so I think that both the cost of borrowing has come down because of low interest rates and the cost of, but the cost of raising revenue, in some respects, there's a lot of room to raise taxes to levels that aren't, they're not detrimentally high. And so I think that we should not forget, just because this is a good time to spend government money, we should not forget that if we borrow money to pay for it, we will have to, that is real debt that has to be paid back in the future. So it's not worth it to borrow money for something that doesn't contribute to our long-term economic productivity. It's not worth it to borrow money that we're just gonna kind of toss out to today's economy and not have any lasting value come out of it. But it is worth borrowing money or raising taxes on things that would not hurt the supply side as much, to pay for investments that contribute to the human part of the productive capacity of our economy. So it's not an excuse to not pay for things, but there's still this need to prioritize what is it that we're spending money on, because everything does have a cost. Whether the cost is, yes, we have to raise taxes and that may decrease certain forms of economic activity, or we have to borrow the money and that will mean we have to pay it back later and we have to make sure we have the capacity to pay it. It means that there still needs to be a rank ordering of desirability of policies, economic policies, no matter how we're paying for it. And that once we figure out how we can pay for it in a way that's not harmful to the overall economic goal, we should be able to kind of rank order our policies from best to worst and stop at some point where the marginal benefit of the new policy does not outweigh the marginal cost of raising the revenue or borrowing the money.
Well, it seems that here's just my take on it, and I don't claim to be an economist, so I may not know what I'm talking about, but if we're going to engage in the new care economy, it will get more expensive over time. And it seems to me that we'll need a revenue source that would keep pace if we're going to do it without just borrowing money. And I agree, you can borrow money for short-term things that are going to pay off. I'd be reluctant to enter into a new ongoing stream of payments like an entitlement program, even mm-hmm. if a worthy one, with an inadequate revenue source. So some right. people, I worry two things, that the president's put this construct on revenue that he can't raise taxes on anybody making below $400,000 a year, which takes off the table some legitimate options like a vehicle mileage tax for transportation, or presumably, depending on how it would be implemented, a carbon tax or a value-added tax. And it seems to me you need something, a big revenue generator like that over the longer term to maintain. And I have to say this for the Concord Coalition point of view, simply paying for a lot of new stuff still leaves us with all the other stuff that we already have. That's if we pay for the new child care entitlements, we still have the elderly entitlements that aren't paid
for.
That's
right.
So we still have a problem. But what about just your quick take on Biden's limitations on how he would raise revenue? And there is a lot of talk. There's about a carbon tax now. And what do you think that?
So this is where I always don't like the politics of tax policy, right? Because it's the politics of tax policy that get you into these odd definitions of who's considered, you know, middle class, and how you don't want to raise taxes on the middle class, and how you keep shrinking the possible tax base that you can get revenue from. And then, you know, there's that tension between the smaller the population that will have to pay higher taxes, the higher those taxes will have to go up, right? So we've been, you know, you and I have talked about the need for, you know, new revenue sources for decades now, right? So this is nothing new, just because now we have new bolder spending plans, right? Because we were already doing pretty
we're already spending
a lot of money and not so well raising the revenue to pay for it. So yeah, theoretically, obviously it would be great. In theory, it would be great if we could turn to new revenue sources that also help other problems, challenges that our society faces, such as, you know, environmental damage and global warming. And so ideally, we would turn to revenue sources that, instead of distorting the economy in bad ways, are distorting the economy in good ways, right? So that's why economists, really left and right, have always loved the idea of carbon taxes. So do I think that's likely to happen anytime soon? No. Do I think it's likely that even the tax increases that Biden is proposing to at least partially pay for these big spending plans, do I think all those are going to go through? No, that's definitely going to be the hardest part to get the Republicans to agree on. You know, they may agree on the spending things, but they're not going to agree on the revenue increases. So I think that it's classic, you know, we're gonna, you know, what is politically popular is, the Biden agenda is extremely politically popular, but it's because mostly people are talking about the investments, the spending, and not so much the tax increases. And the tax increases are popular to the extent that people have all heard it's not going to affect them, right? So it's a winning package in terms of political appeal. It's even a winning, it should even be actually appealing to Republicans more than I'm surprised that they've said or admitted to, because I think it's gonna look bad for the Republicans to say it's a bad idea for the economy, because you're gonna alienate a ton of women by saying that, because, you know, this saying that it's not good to give money to all these families and it'll encourage them to be lazy and stay at home instead of going out back to work. I just think that's not gonna win them a lot of votes. So even among Republican women, I'm just, you know, a little warning to the Republican politicians. So I think that we're headed for big deficits for a long time, Bob. But I was
afraid that's where you would go.
No, but one thing I would say is that economists are not good at considering what will happen to the tax base in the future if this big investment in children actually causes population to grow faster than it would have otherwise. Because, you know, that is an order of magnitude bigger in terms of revenue effects in the future than if you were to raise taxes, raise the marginal tax rates. Also, you know, if there are more of these supports for working families, you are going to get more female labor force participation and male labor force participation. So I just think that economists right now are probably not analyzing the American Families Plan part of the Build Back Better agenda. They're not really analyzing it within the standard economic models, the way that would demonstrate that this could have, pretty good effects in terms of the fiscal outlook longer term.
I think that's possible, and certainly that would be the point. I mean, that would be one of the points, is improving the supply side, as you said, of the labor market, which is one of the things that we need to do to grow the economy. The short term, I wonder if the short term cost of the, or what the lag time is, where the there'd be very even higher deficits, and we're already pretty darn high, and going higher.
You know, if you really overwhelm and swamp any sort of positive effect you would get from the labor market, it seems hard that it would all even out, given where we're starting from.
Yeah.
You know, unless you had also some more robust form of revenue raising. It really seems to me right now, because I kind of agree with you, there's consensus on the spending. I think you'd get a lot of Republicans that would say, we do need to do something on the child care side, and we're going to have to do something more with elder care. And, you know, so there are questions about how you pay for it. But I think that the Republicans need to get serious about paying for things. The message seems to be with Biden, well, you know, we agree with your infrastructure plan. We just, you know, don't have a way to pay for it, you know. And they can't take their 2017 tax cut off the table and say, this is our crown jewel. Right. We're so proud of it. You're never going to touch this, because you kill a negotiation right there. The Democrats, I think, it seems to me, do need to, let me make this specific to Biden, the administration. I think putting these constraints on what revenues they would accept, like nobody under 400,000, it has to be, you know, tax the rich. So it sounds politically popular, but I don't think you can do the magnitude of what they're proposing to do, whether it's a good thing, by basing it on such a narrow segment. And I don't, you know, I'm very, 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 very dubious that you're going to get $1 trillion a year out of what's the tax gap, you know, collecting taxes.
Right.
So anyway, I mean, that's kind of where I'm coming from, is that I don't think the debate has yet turned realistic on either side, but it's a new kind of a debate.
I actually think that if the Biden administration maybe did a better job of convincing people of the economic benefit of the spending side of the package, in an ideal world, people should be willing to pay higher taxes. You know, not just...
if you can, like, I mean, I agree.
A lot of money. Like, if the government's going to pay for my kids' preschool and for their community college, I am willing, I mean, that's worth a lot of money to me, and I would be willing to pay more in taxes, and I'd still come out ahead, right? Like, if there could be more, you know, for most people, even if you raise taxes on everyone, most people are going to come out ahead from this package, right? Because you're going to raise taxes mostly on the rich, but you don't have to limit your tax increases to the rich, because the net benefit is still going to be positive to almost everyone.
I think that would be the I would like it if both sides took this as an opportunity to say, okay, we are all in this together, and we're going to have to negotiate the best way to do something that we think is in the national good. But
imagine them, like, you know, joining hands and singing Kumbaya together? But anyway,
well, that's a good fantasy to end on. We'll end on a high note, and maybe you can do a blog on that on Economist Mom. Where would people find that? Can they just Google Economist Mom and come to your blog?
It's literally economistmom.com. Economist Mom is one word, right? Economistmom.com, yes. And you can also Google Economist Space Mom, and you'll find Economist Mom.
Well, this is Bob Bixby for Facing the Future. I have been talking with the Economist Mom, Diane Lim. Always a pleasure, Diane, and we'll have you back soon. Thank you for listening, and we'll be back next week with another episode of Facing the Future.